took courage, confidence, and a lot of nerve to hit the shot anyway. For those who think that tee shot was courageous, I have a confession to make. I didn't hit my driver. I hit my 3-wood. At the top of the backswing, easy does it. Although the fairway wood shot is designed to crank the ball out there a long way, I don't like to sacrifice a millimeter of accuracy. I keep my swing very controlled. I don't lengthen my swing unnecessarily, and I take special care not to let tension creep into any part of my body. And in contrast to my driver swing, for a fairway wood, both my feet are planted firmly on the ground. Although I allow my hips to turn, my lower body is quieter than with the driver. I allow my left arm to bend a little at the elbow. By keeping it soft and supple, I can generate plenty of speed while preserving touch and control. I also keep my club shaft short of parallel. I turn my shoulders quite a bit, but I don't want the club to get away from me, so my hands are quiet at the top. Remember, at the top of the backswing, you want to feel relaxed yet poised. Don't miss your plane. Swinging the club down on the ideal swing plane is important with every club in the bag, but it's especially crucial with fairway woods. Midway into my downswing, I like to see my club shaft aligned perfectly with the ball. If the club becomes vertical at this point, my downswing would be too steep. If the club becomes more flat or horizontal, I'd have to spin my lower body frantically in order to hit the ball solidly. When the club shaft is on plane, two good things happen. The club feels light and balanced, making it easy to generate all the club head speed I need. More important, there is little chance of hitting a big slice or hook because the club shaft is all but trapped within the perfect little channel I've created. From here, it's actually easier to hit a good shot than a bad one. That's a satisfying feeling that produces confidence. Let me take a moment to talk about fairway woods. You should experiment with several types of fairway woods before deciding which models to include in your set. Before considering loft, lie, and shaft flex, you first need to determine which basic club head design will serve you best. First, there is the utility wood. This type of fairway wood is very popular among amateurs, and you'll even find a few on the senior PGA Tour. The club face is shallow, with most of the weight distributed along the bottom of the club head to hit the ball higher and advance the ball from tall grass. Second, there is the high-lofted fairway wood. This type of fairway wood is useful for the everyday amateur. The head is oversized with a big forgiving sweet spot. It's easy to get the ball airborne, but is also useful off the tee on a short, tight par 4 or a long par 3. It complements the utility wood very well. Most amateurs should carry this model and a utility wood as well. Finally, there is the 3-wood. The club head is medium-sized, the weight distributed fairly evenly along the perimeter and from top to bottom. My 3-wood gives me exceptional feel and control, but you need a lot of club head speed and have to nail the sweet spot to get much out of it. Not a great club to hit from poor lies. If the ball is sitting badly, I'll use an iron. Ultimately, the club style should suit the player, so you decide. Take a moment to look at the side-by-side photos of my position at address and impact. Note that the impact should look like the address. The purpose of addressing the ball correctly is so you can return to that position at impact. These photos aren't spitting images, of course. In the photo at left, I'm absolutely still, while in the photo at right, I'm set to launch the ball at 180 miles per hour. But they are more alike than they are different. You'll note that the club shaft is in almost exactly the same position in both photos, perpendicular to the target line. My spine angle is the same, and my head is in virtually the same spot. It proves how uncomplicated the golf swing can be. The differences can be attributed to speed and motion. My hips and shoulders are rotating furiously in the photo at right and thus are a bit open to the target line. My arms are further forward because they are swinging past my body with as much speed as I can muster. And my right heel is off the ground, though you can't see it well here, to accommodate the movement in my hips and shoulders. So, while I've arrived at a pretty good position at impact, the big lesson here is to set up to the ball in a manner that allows you to swing the club freely with no unnecessary movement in any part of your body. A boring proposition. I'm a big believer in the importance of trajectory in ball flight. Because the fairway woods can have considerable loft, it's all too easy to settle for a high, lazy ball flight. That isn't my style. I like the ball to come off the club face with lots of zip, so it can bore through the wind without being blown offline too much. I like to hear the ball hiss for the first 30 yards or so. A boring ball flight is not just a product of hitting the ball hard. Much of it has to do with the club head's angle of attack, how solidly you hit the ball, and the type of fairway wood you're using. You'll get more out of your fairway woods if you can achieve 1. A level angle of attack into the ball, 2. Center face contact, and 3. A fairway wood that is properly fitted to your swing in terms of weight, shaft flex, and club head design. Once you find the right fairway wood, you'll find the search was well worth the effort. Chase the ball with your right hand. On second shots into long par 4s and short par 5s, you're aiming at a pretty small target. Accuracy is extremely important and not all that easy to achieve. Keep in mind, the fairway wood is a lot longer than, say, your 7-iron and thus is harder to control. The best way for keeping the ball on the straight and narrow is to make the club head track straight down the target line for as long as possible after impact. You should feel you are chasing the ball into the distance with your right hand, keeping the club head low to the ground and allowing your right arm to extend fully after it has struck the ball. This will keep the club face square to the target for a longer period through impact. When I must turn the ball left. Only after years of practice am I able to shape my tee shots at will, without changing the basic character of my swing. The benefit of all this work led to my winning my 6th professional major, and the 4th in a row, the 2001 Masters. The 13th hole at Augusta National is a par 5 that bends sharply to the left about 230 yards out from the tee. The player who can hit a long, controlled draw on demand has a big advantage there, for once the ball turns the corner, it can scamper to within 200 yards of the green. And because of the elusive nature of the firm, undulating green, it's a treat to have a middle iron in your hand to use on your approach shot. Long before I arrived at Augusta for the 2001 Masters, I practiced that draw with my driver and 3-wood for 2 months solid. I would devote a little extra time on the practice tee with that specific shot in my mind's eye. I don't consciously change my mechanics. I do it by feel. My last thought before I take the club back is draw. I got good at hitting the shot in practice, but would it hold up under pressure? I found out in the final round. Nursing a narrow lead over Phil Mickelson and David Duvall, I stood on the 13th tee, determined to bring off that hard, piercing draw. Filled with the confidence that comes from knowing you've prepared yourself well, I grabbed my 3-wood and just ripped the tee shot. The ball not only turned the corner, it didn't stop rolling until it came to rest in a perfect lie, 183 yards from the green. I hit the green easily, and the tap-in birdie that followed kept my lead intact. A lead, as it turned out, I wouldn't lose. How to smoke the driver. If one club in my bag qualifies as being more important than any other, it's the driver. A lot of people will tell you it's the putter, simply because more strokes are made with the flat stick during a round than with any other club. But the driver gets my vote for several reasons. A good drive makes all things possible. My chances of making a birdie or eagle are increased enormously when I crush the ball long and straight. What's more, if my swing with the driver is sound, my swing with the irons tends to be good as well. As the driver goes, so goes the rest of my game from tee to green. But the biggest thing about the driver isn't tactical or mechanical. To me, the driver has the special capability of giving me an emotional lift and a big edge psychologically. A super drive that stops on the center mowing stripe fills me with strength, energy, and confidence. Nowhere was the emotional lift from a good drive more apparent or more necessary than on the final hole of the 2001 Masters. I came to the 18th tee knowing I had the tournament sewn up, provided I made a par 4. A bogey would put me in a playoff against David Duvall. This was not a time to play defensively. I chose the driver and committed myself to ripping the ball almost as hard as I could. I set up to play a fade and swung as aggressively as I had all week. Television viewers saw me hold my finish extra long, and they might have thought I was just enjoying the moment, but I was trying to watch my ball finish. It literally went out of my sight, I thought I might have faded the ball too much around the corner of the dog leg that it could have drifted into the trees on the right. As I walked up the fairway, I saw a ball sitting in the right rough, but it was Phil Mickelson's, not mine. I looked further up ahead, and lo and behold, there was my ball, sitting pretty on the fairway, only 78 yards from the green. Man, was I relieved and excited. The little wedge shot I had left was nothing. And one putt later, I had my second green jacket and fourth straight major championship. A foundation for power. Take a moment to look at the photo under this heading. My stance is wider with the driver than for any other club. That's because my driver swing is longer, wider, and on the downswing at least, a lot faster. Spreading my feet slightly wider than my shoulders gives me the stability I need to really go after it. I flex my knees just a little, enough to make them feel alive and promote easy movement in my trunk and torso. I also pay close attention to my foot position at address. I found that by flaring my right foot out to my right ever so slightly, I'm able to make a modest hip turn without straining my knee and thigh. As for my left foot, I flare it out slightly in the opposite direction, toward the target. This prevents me from turning my hips too far on the backswing and allows me to rotate my upper body freely on the downswing and into my follow-through without putting too much pressure on my leg and back. Finally, I like to angle my knee inward, just a bit at address. That encourages me to turn rather than slide on the backswing and makes it easier to shift my weight to the left on the downswing. Extra width for extra distance. When I'm playing a par 5 that is reachable in 2 and the fairway is fairly wide, I sometimes will swing as hard as I can. When I plan to go all out with a driver, I spread my feet even wider than normal. That gives me a firmer base so I won't lose my balance. What's more, a wider stance helps me station most of my weight on my right side. One of the keys to distance is keeping the upper body to the right of the ball on the downswing, and a wider stance helps me to do that. The wider the stance, the more difficult it is to sway laterally on the forward swing. A powerful start. The sequence of motion on the backswing is the same for the driver as for every other club, but I do pay special attention to my hips. I make absolutely sure that my hips turn rather than slide to my right. Turning the hips is one of the first signs I'm accumulating power. This rotary motion in my hips and shoulders is much like loading a giant spring. By the time I reach the top, my hips and shoulders are primed to unload with tremendous speed. The most common backswing error is shifting your hips laterally to the right. If your right hip moves outside of your right foot, you have to slide back to the left just to hit the ball. It's hard to time that move properly. What's more, you've cut your power by about 50%. Because a sliding motion on the downswing isn't anywhere near as powerful as a rotary unwinding of the hips and shoulders. A good thought is to keep your weight on the inside portion of your right foot, keeping the angle of your right leg constant throughout the backswing. This is something I've worked on since I was a kid. It is an absolute trademark of my swing. The swing that won the slam. When I began working with Butch Harmon in 1993, my swing was pretty rough around the edges. At age 17, I had some knowledge of swing mechanics, but certainly not enough to understand fully what I had to improve upon and how to go about improving it. Butch and I set out to improve the way my body functioned during the swing. With the intent of making the club perform in the most efficient way possible, our goal was to design a swing that was powerful, efficient, accurate, repeatable, and would work with every club in the bag. If I were drawing up a short list of things to copy, it would include 5 main points. First, I turn my shoulders as far as possible without letting the range of motion disrupt my spine angle or the position of my right leg. Second, I make my shoulders and arms work together throughout the swing. I don't let one get too far ahead of or behind the other. That's one of the secrets of good rhythm and tempo. Third, I keep the club face square throughout the swing. That means the club face is parallel with the left wrist and forearm. Fourth, I strive to get the sequence of motion on the downswing just right. My lower body leads the way, followed by my shoulders, arms, and hands. And finally, I hit through the ball, not at it. I want to keep the club head traveling fairly low to the ground for a brief period after impact. That thought will promote solid contact, accuracy, and maximum distance. Just a final note on changing your swing. It's the little modifications you make at the end that are the hardest to incorporate into your game. Sometimes the changes are so subtle they are barely visible to the naked eye and very difficult to implement feel-wise into the swing. But if you can, work with a partner and make the changes at your own pace. Think long and wide. I have two goals on my takeaway: to establish a very wide swing arc and to shift my weight fully to my right side without sliding to my right. I try to extend the butt end of the shaft as far from the right hip as I possibly can, my shoulders turning to make it possible. But my right leg is angled toward the target a bit, even though I've shifted my weight onto my right side. Take a moment to look at the photo under the heading, "My shoulders turn farther than my hips." With the driver, I turn my shoulders as far as they'll go. My hips turn too, but my shoulders turn a lot farther. There should be a healthy feeling of tension and resistance down your left side at the top. From here, all I have to do is unwind my hips a bit and my shoulders will follow, unturning with tremendous speed on the downswing. In this stance, you'll also notice that I turn my left shoulder underneath my chin. I know I'm making a full shoulder turn when my left shoulder turns under my chin. I try to turn my shoulders at least 90 degrees from their position at address, enough so my left shoulder is well behind the ball at the top. Butch Harmon tells me that Ben Hogan used to wear out his shirts at the point where the left shoulder moved under the chin. A full shoulder turn means I don't have to force the issue on the downswing. My shoulders will unwind fast, but smoothly, carrying the arms along with them on their powerful route to impact. Driving with distraction. The driver swing is the most physical act in all of golf, but there's a strong mental aspect to it too. To consistently drive the ball long and straight, you need to be single-minded about what you're doing. You must be totally impervious to distractions and immune to thoughts that can make your swing fall to pieces. Because the driver swing is long and a bit violent in terms of the sheer speed you're trying to generate, timing is extremely important. If you allow something to break your concentration and upset your rhythm or tempo, you're in deep trouble. Staying focused can be a tall order for me, simply because there are large numbers of people very close by on virtually every drive I hit. The gallery grows so quiet when I'm preparing to hit that when someone does speak or a camera clicks, it can sound like a bomb going off. My goal is to be so focused that I don't hear these disruptions, or at least don't allow them to influence my swing. In the final round of the 2001 Masters, I arrived at the 15th tee doing my best to protect a fragile one-shot lead over David Duval. The drive on the 15th, a reachable par 5, is critical. A long, accurate tee shot sets up a middle line approach over water to a firm, sloping green. You really need a birdie there to avoid giving a shot back to the field. This was on my mind as I conducted my pre-shot routine, then set up over the ball. I made a nice full backswing and made my first move down from the top, the club dropping right into the slot. Then, out of nowhere, a camera clicked. Startled badly, I managed to stop my downswing before the club hit the ball. And I'm glad I did, or I might not have gotten that second green jacket. It goes to show that good driving is partly the result of having good concentration and presence of mind. I was focused on what I was doing that day, yet somehow aware of my surroundings. If I can manage myself with a couple of hundred people within whispering distance, you can learn to do it on Saturday mornings with only a couple of buddies nearby. It's cool to be square. The position you establish at the top of your swing serves as a preview of where you'll be at impact. One of my goals is to achieve a square club face at the top of the backswing, meaning it should be parallel with my left forearm. If the toe of the club head were pointing more toward the ground, my club face would be open, and I tend to hit a big slice. If the club face were aimed dead at the sky, the club face would be closed, and I'd lean toward hitting a big hook. Keep club short of parallel. I believe in a big shoulder turn, but I don't like the club dipping past parallel with the ground. Actually, the shoulders aren't to blame for the club going back too far. It happens because the left arm bends too much at the elbow, or the hands don't maintain a firm hold on the club. When the shaft extends beyond parallel, you tend to throw the club from the top with the hands, rather than letting the unturning of the shoulders transport the club into a sound position on the downswing. And on the downswing, let the lower body lead the way. Remember, the sequence of motion is from the ground up. First you shift your weight to your left leg, then you turn your hips with all you've got. The shoulders come next. On my downswing, my shoulders are still square to the target, even though my hips are aligned well to the left. The arms and hands come last. If you've performed everything in order, they'll deliver the club head into the ball along the correct inside path. Remember, the chain of events occurs slowly at first. If you rush, you'll likely unwind your shoulders too soon and perform the dreaded over-the-top move, where the club is delivered into the ball on an out-to-in path. That means a loss of power, and more than likely, a big slice to the right. For more yards, I snap my left leg. When I need an extra 20 yards, I incorporate a special move in my lower body, just before impact. I found by snapping my left leg straight, my hips clear faster and speed up the movement of my shoulders, arms, and legs. This is an unorthodox move meant solely for power. Byron Nelson and many other great ball strikers concentrate on maintaining a bit of flex in their left leg through impact, as that tends to keep the club head moving along the target line longer. But for extra distance, I straighten that left leg as quickly as I can on the through swing. My shoulders and arms match up. One swing problem I have to monitor constantly is not letting my arms lag too far behind my upper body on the downswing. Because my hips and shoulders unwind so quickly, they sometimes outrace my arms. The result is that I drag the club head into the ball from far inside the target line, forcing me to rotate my hands furiously to square the club face at impact. If I don't rotate the hands enough, I push the ball to the right. If I rotate them too much, I hit a big hook. This makes for an inconsistent ball flight. My goal is to keep my arms in front of my body as much as possible throughout the downswing. I keep my arms in front of my chest and my shoulders aligned only slightly left of the target line. If I've timed everything well on this swing, you can bet the ball will fly a mile in a controlled direction. Fancy footwork. A lot has been said and written about footwork during the swing, but I've never looked at the feet as superactive components. I believe the feet merely react to the motion occurring elsewhere in your body. If your footwork appears loose and sloppy, it's because something else in your swing isn't right. I allow my right foot to come off the ground just before impact. I really have no choice. My hips and shoulders rotate so fast and my weight has shifted so aggressively, I'd hurt my back if I kept my right heel on the ground. If my right heel stays glued to the turf, I'm not using my lower body enough. At the finish, I've released my right foot, allowing it to come up on its toe. That's evidence of proper weight distribution throughout the downswing and a full, complete follow-through. At the finish, I should be able to hold this position without losing my balance. That's the sign of good balance. My swing through the ages. I was a decent player at age 16, good enough to have won 2 U.S. junior amateur titles with a third on the way. But my full swing technique then was not as sound as it would be at age 20, and nowhere near as good as at age 24. There is always room for improvement. The biggest area of improvement is in the way I use my lower body. As a kid, I really whipped my hips and shoulders through the ball on the downswing. They moved so fast, my arms simply couldn't keep up. It put huge demands on my timing. I've since learned to make my hips, shoulders, and arms work more in sync. My goal of becoming a more consistent, versatile ball striker is finally within reach. I shake hands with the target. One of Butch Harmon's favorite reminders on the follow-through is to shake hands with the target. My right arm is fully extended straight down the target line. That shows I've tried to generate as much club head speed as possible. If my right forearm is rolling over the left, that's a sign of natural hand rotation, of moving the club face to a square or slightly closed position. how I hit my driver off the deck. When playing super long par 5 holes, I occasionally have so far to go on my second shot that my 3-wood just won't get me there. If my lie is very good, I'll hit my driver from the fairway. It's a tough shot to pull off consistently, but the reward can be great. In some cases, I can get 300 yards out of the shot. The first thing I do is play the ball about an inch farther back in my stance than normal. I also position my hands so they are almost even with the ball. I open my stance a bit as well. That's because I play a fade exclusively on this shot. I make a very long backswing, making sure I turn my shoulders as fully as possible. This shot is all about good timing, so I make sure I don't rush. I start down slowly and then let my swing gather speed, so the club head is just ripping through the air by the time it gets to the ball. I want to sweep the ball cleanly off the turf without taking any divot at all. When everything happens just right, the ball takes off like a bullet to the left of the target, makes a little turn to the right, then runs a good distance after it lands. To this point, I've talked very little about how much club head speed I actually generate through impact. Here are the numbers from an analysis made in 1998. Through the hitting area, my club head is moving at 119 miles per hour, with my ball coming off the club face at 180 miles per hour. That isn't as fast as some of the guys who enter national long drive contests, but it's definitely up there for a PGA Tour pro. The result is plenty of distance with every club in the bag. The game became much easier for me when I was capable of reaching most par 5 holes in 2 shots and was able to hit the ball higher and softer with less effort. I once did a photo shoot with a camera known as the Holter. It can shoot up to 65 frames per second. When the photographs taken that day were developed, the editors of Golf Digest informed me of a unique problem. They didn't have many shots of me precisely at impact. My club head moved through the ball so quickly that the camera only caught the moment of truth a few times. The next time they photographed my swing, they asked me to make a few extra swings from each angle to be sure they caught my club in contact with the ball. Now that's fast. Driver education. Let me follow through by reviewing the key points I've talked about so far. The width of my stance should be wide enough to provide stability, but narrow enough to promote a full body turn. I hold my head high at address, so my left shoulder can turn under my chin. On the backswing, I make sure my hips turn, but don't slide. I make my backswing as wide as possible by extending my hands away from my right hip and turning my shoulders as far as they'll go. I turn my shoulders fully, but don't allow the club to dip past parallel. For good timing, I keep my hands and arms in front of my chest throughout the swing. For power, with no loss of accuracy, I extend my right hand straight down the target line after impact. Playing the game. When you're on the course, all the hard work starts to pay off. But first, let me talk about when golf gets ugly. If you play this game long enough, eventually you'll face some adversity. It's how you handle those days when the game gets mean and shows its ugly side that defines who you are as a competitor. I've had my share of those days, perhaps none more memorable or forgettable than the first Thursday in April of 1997. It is the case of the missing golf swing, not quite worthy of Agatha Christie, but a mystery nonetheless. It's funny, I didn't feel that nervous when I stepped on the first tee at Augusta National during the first round of the Masters. I mean, no more nervous than usual. I certainly didn't feel too bad. I felt pretty good about my game that week, and pretty good about my putting too. Then, all of a sudden, I hit a pool hook off the tee. The ball ducked into the rough like a jackrabbit and nestled into a bed of pine needles among the trees. Just like that, I make bogey. Not the kind of start I'd planned. To make matters worse, I failed to make birdie at number 2, a par 5 reachable for average-length tour players. Things progressively went downhill from there. I hit one of the worst shots ever. At the par 3 fourth, the pin was in the back left corner. The wind was kind of swirling in the corner of the golf course, going back and forth, from straight right to left, to into me from the left. But when I finished my pre-shot routine and set up to hit the ball, I knew exactly which way it was blowing, so I went ahead and hit it. The ball flared about 30 yards short and 40 yards offline, finishing in the bamboo trees on the right. I didn't even know there were bamboo trees over there. I actually did well to make bogey, but the roller coaster continued its descent. When I got to the 10th tee, I was 4 over par and kind of in a state of shock, like a fighter who had taken a good shot to the chin. I glanced at the giant scoreboard over at 18 and saw that 4 under was leading. I was only 8 back. I said, "You know what? If I can get to even par, I'll be right in this ball game." Because scoring conditions weren't exactly easy that day, not a whole lot of people went low. John Houston shot 67 to lead. So I said, "Let's just get back to even par, and let's start with this swing here, the same one that you've been making all week in practice." I went with my 2-iron and hit a nice little draw down there. From there, all I tried to do was keep the same swing and rhythm throughout the back 9. And somehow, it worked. I shot 30 and got right back in the ball game. In fact, I kept that rhythm for the most part the remaining 3 days. The rest is history. The golf swing can be like a chameleon, changing sometimes from hole to hole, perhaps even shot to shot for high handicappers. The ultimate goal is to find one that repeats and holds up under pressure. Truth is, we all have swing faults that make the quest for repeating a swing difficult. I had a few myself, including one that still rears its ugly head on occasion. I would get the club face closed at the top of my backswing, mainly because my grip was too strong, and I'd have to manipulate the club head with my hands in an effort to square the face at impact. I've also fought the tendency to get trapped or stuck on the downswing, my arms and club lagging too far behind my upper body. To remedy that, I try to keep the club in front of me on the downswing. When I'm unsuccessful, again, I have to rely on my hands to square the club. Fortunately, I've always had very fast hands. My short iron play was not up to par, mainly because my swing speed was much too fast. Thanks to a lot of hard work, my club position is much better at the top of my swing. I rarely get stuck on the downswing, and I've learned how to control the speed of my swing on those scoring shots. But there have been moments where those swing faults cost me dearly. In the opening round of the 96 U.S. Open at Oakland Hills Country Club in Bloomfield, Michigan, I was cruising along at 3-under when the game all of a sudden turned really ugly, all because of a swing fault. I hit my tee shot in the middle of the fairway on the 16th. A medium-length par 4. Pin was middle right, and there was a little wind coming off the left. I got stuck with the 6-iron and hit my approach straight right. The ball landed on the bank and rolled into the water. I proceeded to hit a sand wedge from the drop area, just short of the hole, but the ball skipped up close to the hole, then ripped right back into the water. I hit kind of an indifferent 7th onto the green and 2-putted for 9. I did come back the next day and shoot 69 to make the cut, but the damage had been done. Then there was the 97 British Open. I tried to hood a little holder to counteract the shut club face at the famous postage stamp hole, number 8, at Royal Troon during the final round. Played it too far right, and instead of riding the wind as much as I thought, the ball dived into the bunker and plugged. Took me 2 to get out of that beach sand, and I 3-putted for triple. Any chance I had of winning disappeared right there. But my most embarrassing train wreck occurred at Jack Nicklaus's tournament, the Memorial, in 1997. I remember a thunderstorm rolling in and it raining buckets. It took 5 days to finish the event. At the 3rd hole, a short par 4 that normally requires a layup with an iron off the tee to avoid the water hazard, I spun my approach from 115 yards into the water. After repeating the same shot, I finally got one on the green, which by now was soaking wet. The horn had sounded, suspending play, but I was determined to finish the hole. I hit my first putt, about halfway to the hole, then 2-putted from there for 9. Besides hitting 2 of the worst shots I hit in a long time, I compounded the problem by totally losing my concentration. So, not only can swing faults lead to trouble, frustration can double it, or in this case, quintuple it. Even if you fix swing faults, which I was finally able to do by the 1999 season, you're still not going to make a perfect swing every time. A big reason for my success is the fact that my misses are not as bad as they once were. I have fewer train wrecks. Sometimes, even when you're swinging well, bad breaks can throw you off. Knowing how to play trouble shots can help with damage control and keep you from making a bad situation worse. Know when and when not to be a hero. When I do hit an errant tee shot, I've learned to accept it and just get the ball back into play, most of the time. There are times, though, if I'm two down with two to play and have to make birdie, for example, that I will still try to hit the heroic shot. That's also part of what makes the game fun. I relish successful escapes, but believe me, I assess the percentages before I attempt one. For example, the low hook. I've had plenty of practice on this particular shot, especially when I was younger and had less control of my driver. First, you must set up with a slightly wider stance than normal and position the ball slightly back of center. Aim your feet, hips, and shoulders squarely, but to the right of this target. Take the club back, low and wide along the line of your feet. Regulate the amount of hook by how much you toe in the club at address, not by manipulating the club head with the hands during the swing. Work the ball with your big muscles. Most amateurs aim too far to the right, get very steep on the backswing, and too vertical on the downswing. The result is often a fat shot. Instead, feel as if you're making a sweeping motion with the club and swing through the ball from inside the target line. The big cut. I keep club's toe from turning left. I like to visualize the ball flight, where I want the ball to start and finish, then commit to it. I use one to two more clubs than normal for the distance the shot has to cover. I open my stance and the club face slightly at address and play the ball back or forward in my stance, depending upon how low or high I need to hit it. The swing path should be a little more outside on the backswing and inside after impact. Limit the release of the club through the shot, keeping the toe of the club from turning to the left. Remember, when you really need to curve the ball, exaggerate everything. Don't let a sand divot freak you out. We all have had shots somehow find their way to some strange destination. I've seen mine wind up in the middle of a gorse thicket, in front of a fist-sized rock, up against a tree stump, and directly behind a giant boulder, just to name a few. Most of those were the result of an errant tee shot. What leaves me scratching my head is when I hit a perfect drive and the ball lands in a sand divot. When that happens, it helps to have a positive outlook in a negative situation. Believing you can execute a shot is as important as knowing how to do it. A sand divot hole is just a miniature fairway bunker, and the shot should be executed like a fairway bunker shot. Play the ball back in your stance, slightly more than normal. That will help you contact the ball first, critical to playing the shot. Stand a little taller at address, so you can pick the ball off the sand just as you would in a fairway bunker. Your backswing should be a little steeper than normal, which will also help you contact the ball first, then the sand. Select one more club than you normally need for the yardage, so you can swing easier and keep your balance. Average players often try to beat down on the ball or scoop it from a sand divot. Instead, think of extending the divot as you swing through the ball. That will ensure solid contact. One of my key thoughts, just like in a fairway bunker, I try to keep my lower body quiet on this shot, swinging mostly my arms. That will also help ensure a solid hit, which is crucial from this type of lie. Mutter than heck. I've played the game long enough never to question the fairness of it. Sometimes, though, I'm tempted, like when because of course conditions or an unlucky bounce, my ball picks up mud. The key to playing a mud ball is understanding how mud affects ball flight. As a rule of thumb, the ball will go in the opposite direction of the mud. If mud is on the left side of the ball, the tendency is for the ball to travel more to the right than normal, and vice versa. What makes the shot more problematic is determining the direction and distance it will travel. Also, the harder you swing, the more spin you impart on the ball, causing it to move more offline. Because mud on the right side of the ball means it will go left, I must adjust my setup to allow for that movement. The last thing I want to do is to accentuate ball movement. So, to control ball flight, I select one club higher than normal and make a softer swing. Finally, I must have ample extension on the follow-through to a less than full finish, an indication that I didn't quit on the shot. Don't get waterlogged. My adventures with water hazards have been mostly the Deep Six standard, making a drop the only choice. But on occasion, I have been confronted with a partially submerged ball. It's not the most difficult shot when proper technique is applied. My first move is to take off my shoes and socks and put on my rain suit. Then I approach the shot, exactly like I would a greenside bunker explosion. I open my stance and club face, then I position the ball toward the front of my stance and focus on a spot about an inch behind the ball. I cock my wrists quickly on the backswing to a full wrist cock and take the club up steeply, just as I would on a normal bunker shot. I swing about 50% harder, though, because of the water's density compared with sand. My final thought is to accelerate through impact. I don't want to quit on the shot. I'm always more than a little nervous about being an unwanted guest in some creature's habitat, so rather than rush the shot, I prefer to let my caddy test the water first. How to keep your cool in the heat. Sometimes, playing conditions contribute to golf's ugliness. As a native of Southern California, I'm a warm weather player. I like it when the greens are rolling fast and the mercury is rising. Of course, sometimes it gets so hot it can affect your game, physically and mentally. I love returning to my mom's homeland, but it seems every time I go to Thailand for a tournament, they're in the middle of a heat wave. On my trip there for the 2000 Johnny Walker Classic, it was about 100 degrees every day, with humidity to match. Thanks to physical conditioning, I'm able to endure the heat, but I also take several precautions when it gets too hot. I also use common sense to help me handle extremely cold and rainy conditions. I wear light colors as much as possible, except the final round, when I must wear red. I avoid becoming dehydrated by drinking plenty of water. I like to eat fruit, apples and bananas, and or fruit bars to keep my potassium level up. I also like energy bars because they seem to be easier to digest. I dampen one end of my towel and use it as a cooling agent. I keep the other end dry for the moisture on my hands and grips. I wear a cap to keep the direct sunshine from my head. I have at least a half a dozen gloves available so I can change as often as necessary. I walk slower between shots to conserve energy. I focus only on what I can control, my next shot, not things I can't, like the heat. How to keep your engine from freezing. Unlike most sports, golf is sometimes played in the foulest weather. When it's cold outside, I want to be sure to stay warm inside. Here's how I do it. I prefer layering of lightweight clothing instead of a heavy parka. Silk undergarments help keep in my body heat. Since most of my body heat escapes through my head, I wear a wool ski cap. I'm not one for wool mittens, they just don't look manly. But I will use one of those glycerin heat packs to keep my hands warm. I also might do some extra stretching, because cold weather tends to restrict muscles, and I walk faster between shots to produce more body heat. Ultimately, I focus only on what I can control, and I can't control the weather. How to keep from feeling all wet. Whoever said it never rains on the golf course never played tournament golf. Even in casual play, rain can ruin a perfectly good time if I'm not prepared. Here are my waterproofing tips. I use a sturdy, windproof umbrella. I keep a good quantity of gloves in my bag and change as necessary. I keep an extra towel in my umbrella. I have learned that a good rain suit is a must. I keep an extra pair of socks available. I wear a cap to keep my head dry. I sometimes turn the bill of my cap backward so water doesn't drip through my vision as I bend over to chip or putt. I try to play to my normal pace and rhythm. I don't let inclement weather make me rush a shot. I focus only on what I can control, my game, despite the conditions. Knockdown, not out. From the start, my intentions were to be an international player, so I developed a love for links courses. Of course, that meant I had to become a decent wind player if I wanted to be successful internationally. My coach, Butch Harmon, taught me a shot during the 1995 U.S. Amateur at Newport, Rhode Island Country Club that I've employed many times since to combat windy conditions. The knockdown is one of those shots that, when executed properly, can anchor your game, even in gale-force winds. Take more club and swing easy. The knockdown allows you to control ball trajectory. The less airtime the ball has, the less it will be affected by the wind. The key to controlling distance against a strong wind is to take more club and swing easy. That reduces backspin. The average player tries to hit the ball too hard against the wind. That just adds backspin and makes the ball balloon up in the air. Sit on it. Take a stance that's a little wider than normal, and at address, try to sit down by bending your knees slightly more than normal. Position the ball slightly back of center in your stance. Take a three-quarter backswing, keeping the club very low and wide on the takeaway. Think low and wide. You want to swing relatively wide, both back and down. A common amateur mistake is to make a steep downswing and take a deep divot. The ball shoots up in the air because of increased backspin. Through impact, keep your hands low and your finish abbreviated and balanced. The result should be a shot that flies low and is minimally affected by the wind. How I whip the wind. When the wind is howling, I want the ball to spend as little time in the air as possible. That means hitting the knockdown, the low wind cheating shot, that can keep my score intact, even in the most vicious winds. I program my ball flight. I make three pre-swing adjustments. First, I position the ball back in my stance, just to the right of center. Next, I choose more club, both to reduce loft and allow me to make an easier swing. Finally, I widen my stance for extra stability and flex my knees more than usual. I'm all set to drill the ball through any breeze. I shorten swing, keep hands low. The knockdown shot is all about control. Balance is a must. So I make only a three-quarter backswing, trusting my less lofted club selection to achieve the distance I need. I keep my swing fairly wide, both back and down. I swing through the ball on a shallow angle, taking a very thin divot. I don't hit down on the ball too steeply, into the wind. I also keep my hands very low into the follow-through, swinging through to a fairly short finish. Follow these rules, and you'll be amazed at how little effect the wind has on your shots. Two deadly ball flights. If you're spending too much time in trouble, then there's a good chance the thing making golf so ugly is your swing. It is probably totally out of control. Most of my high handicap pro-am partners suffer from either of two deadly ball flights, the right-to-right push-slice or the left-to-left pull-hook. Several factors could be responsible for both shots, from grip to swing plane to body rotation. Here are a couple of cures for what might ail your ball flight. If you slice the ball, the club face is open at impact. Often the culprit is the wrists and or the forearms. The forearms rotate too much on the takeaway, and the left wrist is cupped at the top of the backswing. The result is an open club face at the top, meaning it points more vertically than horizontally. Open at the top usually means open at the bottom, too, and a huge slice. Combine that with a swing path too much from the inside, and the ball has to go right. You want more of a flat left wrist and a square club face at the top of the backswing. You can attain that position by having quieter hands and restricting forearm rotation on the backswing. Use a mirror to check the angle created by your left wrist. The more cupped it is, the more likely you'll hit a banana ball. If you hook the ball, the club face is closed at impact. Most hookers suffer from a lack of body rotation on the through swing. They start with the chin buried in the chest on the takeaway and never really rotate fully away from the ball on the backswing. Since they can't unwind what they don't wind up in the first place, they fail to rotate fully toward the target. What small amount of weight they have transferred to the right side remains there. To compensate on the downswing, they flip their wrists, towing in the club and producing a snapper. The ball starts left and then hooks. To fix the problem, stay connected. That is, make sure the triangle created by your hands, arms, and chest at address remains intact throughout the swing. If you maintain that connection, your weight will naturally shift into your right side on the backswing and transfer to your left side on the downswing. Sometimes ugly is not so bad. On the final playoff hole of the 2000 PGA Championship at Valhalla Country Club in Louisville, I nearly pull-hooked my tee shot into the parking lot. Fortunately, it bounced off of a tree and onto a cart path, rolling into a playable lie and averting what could have been a disaster. I managed to get the ball back into play, then hit my approach on the par 5 into a greenside bunker. From there, I exploded to within 2 feet of the hole. A very ugly par secured my 5th professional major. Let me end this section by saying that one of the keys to my success has been that I develop a game plan and I stick to it. Next up, I'll talk about how to stay in control of your game. Managing your game. Pop had a mantra. "Son," he would say, "you get out of it what you put into it." When I would get frustrated, those words were gentle persuasion to try again. Because of them, I understood very early that no matter how many physical gifts a person might have, to refine them, you must bust your butt. I quickly bought into the idea that the road to success is paved with sweat and calluses. I also was taught how to manage the game instead of letting the game manage me. Pop has often told the story about my first lesson in course management. I don't remember it. Heck, I was barely out of training pants at the time. But I believe in its veracity because my course management today is a reflection of it. As the story goes, Pop and I were playing the Navy course near my home in Cypress, California. On the second hole, I hit my drive behind a large clump of trees. Pop asked me, what was I going to do? I looked at him as if to say, what do you mean? He said, son, I'm going to make 2 contributions to your golf game. One is mental toughness, and the other, course management. Now, what are you going to do, Tiger? I said, I can hit the ball underneath the trees, but there's a great big sand trap in front of the green. Pop nodded. I said, I can't hit the ball over the trees because they're too tall. Pop nodded again. I said, I can hit my ball back into the fairway, then onto the green, and one putt for par. He said, son, that is course management. Pop was ex-military and definitely old school. He believes there is a standard operating procedure, SOP, for every undertaking, including golf. But when he sprang that one on me, I did what any 3-year-old would do. I asked why. He explained to me that the starting point of every shot is behind the ball, that you must visualize the shot and assess all the potential problems, then commit to the shot that you want to hit. I didn't realize it at the time, but my most important lesson in course management began with Pop's insistence that I have a pre-shot routine. Every so often, I would forget to go through my routine, but before long, it became ingrained. In fact, I believe it helped me win my very first Southern California Junior Golf Association tournament. I must have looked pretty regimented as I went through my routine, but I didn't care. It's what I knew, and I felt comfortable. Not many of the other kids approached the game that way. Well, I shot 120, but I won. Mom and Pop were so proud of me. I guess I was really proud, too. By the way, I use the same pre-shot routine today. It doesn't matter what your individual pre-shot routine is, just as long as you do it the same way every time, and you don't hold up play. Great players operate in the moment. In other words, they never get ahead of themselves, and they never ever appear overwhelmed by any situation. One of the reasons I'm able to hit good shots is because I go through the same routine. I learned it from my dad, who had read it from Jack Nicklaus. It's been said that you can put a stopwatch on Nicklaus, and his routine will be the same every time. Granted, his might be a little slower than most guys, but It is his natural rhythm. If you notice, my pre-shot routine doesn't vary, and it is uniquely mine. It helps me remain calm and in the present, prepare to execute a shot to the best of my ability. Preparation is a big part of course management. It's like cramming for a final exam. You want to be armed with all the answers so you can score your best. The first thing I do to prepare for a tournament is clear my mind. I don't dwell on what I did or didn't do in the event just completed. I might reflect on it later, but I won't clutter my head with things I have no control over. I want to start every tournament fresh mentally. Freeing my mind of everything that has happened up to that point is how I accomplish it. When I was an amateur, my dad and I would come up with a game plan for how to play certain holes. As a matter of fact, the first time I played the Masters in 1995, I spent many hours reviewing videotapes of telecasts to get a feel for Augusta National. Then I put a game plan together. Of course, you don't want to be too rigid in your approach. I eventually grew out of that routine because I felt it wasn't flexible enough. Now I prefer to go in with a blank slate and let the situation dictate what I can and cannot do. True, I'm equipped with a much better swing now, so I can more easily handle different situations. That also keeps me from forming preconceived notions of what club I have to hit off of a certain tee because situations change. Sometimes you need to be more aggressive, other times less aggressive. You have to be flexible. When I'm preparing for a familiar course, like Augusta National, and have a week off to get ready, I like to go home and practice. I specifically work on certain shots I'll need during the tournament. For example, I know that I need to hit a sweeping draw tee shot on the par 5 13th because of the pine seedlings that were planted in the right rough. I will work on that shot extensively to give myself a better chance of executing it under the gun. If a course is set up similar to a major championship like Muirfield Village was in 2000, 2 weeks prior to the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, I'll practice shots that I might need in the major. That year, the greenside rough at Muirfield Village was about 4 inches in some spots, and the greens were firm and typically fast, just like I knew they would be at Pebble. So I practiced hitting that little chop shot from the rough, letting the ball feed to the hole. It not only came in handy for me in the Memorial, which I won, but it was a big part of my arsenal during the Open victory. Practice rounds are crucial when I'm playing a course for the first time. That's when my caddy and I get to know the lay of the land. We have a laundry list of things we look for, from what shape of shot to hit on each hole to how receptive the greens are to shots of varying trajectories. The successful golfer not only knows what he can do, but what he can afford to do. Another factor you must take into account when preparing for a tournament is type of course, links or parkland, short and tight, or long and wide open. I've grown to prefer links courses, like those in the British Open Rota, because they are the ultimate challenge to a player's creativity and resourcefulness. We play mostly